You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson. Today's date is the 21st of June, 2026. The 21st. It was just March a few days ago. I don't understand it. Anyway, I want to thank my donors. Since I've been ill and I've been better, thank God, for quite some time now. I do have some substantial bills, despite having halfway decent insurance. And, there are still some outstanding things. And, my audience and Pete, Kihonis' audience have been, wonderful to me. And, I truly appreciate it. Everyone's talking about Iran, and quite frankly, I'm sick of it. What's happening there, I predicted some time ago. I'm losing interest. Well, I'm easily bored anyway, but I'm losing interest in it. All my predictions come true. All those from the talking heads and the media, they never come true. And it's not that I have some crystal ball. It's because I am able to remove extraneous detail and get right to the heart of the matter. Things are winding down there, as they are in Ukraine. At least in part because the U.S. wants to train what's left of its guns on China. I am working on a book on the awful condition of the U.S. military today. It may irritate some people, but it's irrefutable. It simply is, you know, the U.S. is not a superpower. China has been ahead of the United States economically, not just in purchasing power parity, which is, you know, PPP, but also in nominal terms for some time. And the U.S. counts, you know, money made from financial instruments as growth. And, of course, that's nothing. It's just debt upon debt. China actually makes things. As you well know, Willis Cardo said to me many years ago that China is a national socialist state, and I firmly agree. National socialism you could find all over the world. So I want to get into that. It's going to be very important in the next decade or so. I want to tell you the things that you're not being told about recent Chinese history. Let's go back to the 1990s. The Communist Party of China was still struggling with the situation that emerged out of the wreckage with what had been Maoist China. Mao was the greatest mass murderer of all time. It took decades to heal. Although Noam Chomsky continues to defend his legacy. But 1990 is important because you couldn't really identify China as a Marxist regime anymore. Maybe rhetorically, there was nothing Marxist about it. By 1990, China was an anti-liberal, at least an anti-liberal state in a strained economic environment. Largely the fault, of course, of Mao and what he did to the country. China's economy was class-based, sometimes influenced by personal profit, and even the market sometimes, still had a great degree of state dominance. Information was controlled entirely by the party until roughly the 2000s, and dissenters were punished if they became too well-known. Even the police functions were party-based, not national or regional, but this also was soon to change. To accomplish the nation's recovery from Maoism, and you can't, if the Maoist slaughter wasn't a trauma for any group of people, then nothing is. The party created a general program of rapid industrialization. Now, labor started off with fairly low wages, but that really doesn't matter because you had a low cost of living. They generalized state plan of building the basic infrastructure that would undergird any form of modern industrialization. There was the introduction of the so-called discretionary market, and sometimes even the conditional permission to profit from the ownership and employment of capital. What choice did they have? It's almost like these years were some form of therapy. What was developing from Deng Xiaoping onward? The communism with Chinese characteristics is National Socialism in their own way. This is very different from Leninist or Stalinist planning. Go back even further. The concept of Western representative democracy, which is very broad. Representative democracy and liberal democracy are two very different things. That had become mainstream among Chinese intellectuals thanks to Sun Yat-sen. Sun created the Nationalist Party, eventually driven out by Mao. What he advocated was a strong mixed government with three branches, vaguely on the American model, the American ideal model, I should say. He stressed the use of referendums. However, he was forced to deal with the fact that as part of the third, maybe even the fourth world at this point, in this environment, this global capitalist and Darwinian struggle of international political economy, the state would have to continue to be powerful, but not abstract. It would have to be based on the Han ethnos that defines China as such. Sun sought an interventionist nationalist state, however you want to define the term, that would control at least the fundamental sectors, that is, heavy industry and foreign trade, of this new economy. This was a revolutionary party, and the responsibility of building a new form of the developmental state had nothing to do with Marx, had nothing to do with class struggle, had nothing to do with the proletarian revolution, but then again, neither did Marxism. Internationalism is one of these things, like rejecting free will, or relativism. People who accept it can't really consistently. Internationalism is so vapid and absurd, it had to be rejected. Sun argued that Marxism and Leninism, which were one and the same, as far as I'm concerned, they were systems designed to resolve the problems of Western industry. The Third World was a different story. Popular sovereignty, again, a very different idea from liberal democracy. Self-government, he said, is the foundation of a nation. That's also very broad, but it's also perfectly consistent with nationalism. Oftentimes, strong military rulers and monarchs are representative, even though they're not elected. Mao died, thank God, in 1976. The architect of all of this was Deng Xiaoping, who died in 1997. He had four cardinal principles. These were the fundamental axioms of the new state. The democratic dictatorship and single-party dominance, that is, the party as representative of most Chinese in most respects. Strangely, the fourth one is the thought of Mao Zedong. Well, okay, this is symbolic. It's used to satisfy his followers in the country. Though a minority, they can be loud. So democratic dictatorship, single-party dominance, party representative, etc. Deng created a state that, despite the introduction of private property and limited market, he vehemently was opposed to the development of a bourgeoisie that would then become wealthy and seek to limit the party's power. Only the party was capable of overseeing the economy. I've said before, every country has a choice between oligarchy and monarchy. Well, this was their version of monarchy. None of this had anything to do with Maoism. Of course, reform came from the top down at first, but it was implemented at the regional and local levels. Deng Xiaoping and Jiang Zemin created a social nationalist network, and you cannot deny its success. One of the most successful projects of all time, economically speaking, on the world stage. So long as that bourgeoisie was not permitted to develop, opposition from the moneyed class would be out of the question. Yet since the beginning of the 20th century, nationalists have sought the power of the state to confront foreign capital. Remember, the state is a protective coating for the ethnos, and certainly protection from huge capitalists and foreign enterprises. China was very concerned, especially with sovereignty, and past injustices. They have taken markets and resources from the unstable liberal systems of the West and have dominated them. Western capital cannot take advantage of the country's success and eventually control it. All Western investment in China has to benefit China in some way. They have to pay quite a bit of money to be there. They can be successful there. But now, increasingly, Chinese capital is taking over. The book that I want to cite is from Jonathan Walton from 2008. I have issues with it, and we'll get to that in a minute. It's called The Revival of Chinese Nationalism, Challenges to American Ideals and Interests in East Asia. And he talks about the position of your basic intelligentsia of China at the time. And there was a fourfold crisis, according to him. Number one, the crisis of ideology, connected to Mao's downfall, and really the lack of a state ideology to replace it. Worse, the problem of continuously making reference to Marxism while having a market-based political system, state market-based political system. And it confuses a lot of people. It continues to do so. Number two, a moral crisis. What is Chinese tradition? The decline of the authority of the Chinese elite, along with corruption. And corruption is going to come in, and you have a leadership vacuum. Number three, an institutional crisis. There was no rule of law, at least early on, relative to both the state and the economy. But something like this had to develop to take the place of Maoism. And finally, a pragmatic crisis of results. People have lost trust in the party state because of its failure to deliver practical results and increase their personal well-being. Now, of course, number four is no longer an issue. All of these revolts, whether it be in Xinjiang or Tibet, I asked the question, what are you going to do better? than China. Your economies are going through the roof because of investment from Beijing. What's your independence going to do? What practical effect is it going to have? And the truth is, of course, none, because these are created by the West. Now, I don't like the idea that he seemed to suggest that Maoism was an ideological consensus that a country might embrace. No, Maoism was a war waged on China itself, not a unifying ideology. Remember, the West never had a problem with China during the worst of Mao's mass murders, or those of its client, Cambodia. But Maoism didn't unify anybody. I think socialism with Chinese characteristics did, and does today. Once the Maoist era was gone, and that generation was gone, you still had a lack of leadership and no ideology for the reform process. Of course, the postmodern West has zero ideology and zero principles. Still, China wasn't going to go down that route. They had to fight the emerging bourgeoisie. By the late 1980s, the party was worried about this. What came out of it in the mid to late 80s was this so-called popular unrest, especially in urban areas. After, and of course, the West invented the massacre at Tiananmen Square, June 4th, 1989. Now, let me, I know I've talked about this before. There was no such massacre. It didn't happen. All right? The massacre came from one article from the BBC in 1989. I don't think I want to quote it. When this book comes out, it's going to be quoted at length because of its historical significance. You know, when it was first published, I was too young to see the absurdity. I didn't fully understand it. But this story that he published then was so ridiculous and so full of, no pun intended, so full of holes that that it couldn't possibly be true. But it was designed to appeal to a Western audience, not to depict facts on the ground. That's what journalism does. That's what propaganda is supposed to do. I don't know how many people realize that the Chinese army lost about 100 armored vehicles during the Tiananmen crisis. Dozens of casualties, including 10 killed. So obviously the narrative isn't true. I remember the stories of troops firing indiscriminately, which, of course, professional armies don't do. This guy writing for the BBC who didn't speak Chinese is supposed to be right there in the line of fire, and, of course, wasn't, and was translating somehow what everyone was saying. He just simply made it up. Amazingly, not a single picture was ever taken from any of these incidents. The story was a fabrication. And the worst part was that few caught on to this at the time. And the Chinese media is better than the American media. Caleb Mialpin, who writes on media issues quite often, he said this: regardless of how many times the Tiananmen narrative is refuted, Western media continues to repeat it. The words of Nicholas Kristof, James Miles from the BBC, the Chinese government, and eyewitnesses, accounts of the Chilean diplomats who were right there on the square, are just ignored. An event that was far more complex, involving lots of confusion and violence on both sides, has been retold to Western audiences as some kind of classical tragedy. The West did nothing as Mao slaughtered tens of millions, but imposed sanctions with this invented massacre. See, the embassy, the Chilean embassy is significant because it's right on the square. They can see it. And they said there was no such thing. It simply didn't happen. WikiLeaks, no bloodshed inside Tiananmen Square, cables claim. That was June 4th, 2011. James Miles, who worked for the BBC, did confess. He said, I might have given the wrong impression. There was no massacre on Tiananmen Square that day. The claim was that they witnessed a lot of this from the their rooms at the Beijing Hotel. But the Beijing Hotel, you cannot see the square from there. Richard Roth of CBS News said the same thing. There was no Tiananmen Square massacre. He said he was there at the time. He said, we saw no bodies, injured people, ambulances, or medical personnel. Nothing to even suggest, let alone prove, that a massacre had recently occurred in that place. They did see dead soldiers and captured tank crews. And that came straight from the U.S. Embassy. Declassified U.S. Embassy documents from 1989 also said that there was no massacre. You see, something that everyone needs to keep their eye on, or lookout for are these pictures. People will post pictures with bodies in it. And if you caption it, these are bodies of killed by the Chinese military in 1989, they'll believe it. They did this tremendously in the Vietnam War. Johnson's Law takes root here. There was a major picture that circulated widely at the time showing two bodies mutilated, and it was simply murdered protesters. Unfortunately, there were two soldiers. Now, how many Chinese soldiers were killed? It ranges between 12 and 200. They were not unarmed protesters, but they were from the wealthy classes. These were not poor kids. This is exactly what the state was trying to avoid. This is the key concept. It was their version of maybe the Decemberist Revolt or even trying to create a French Revolution, this new moneyed class that thought that its money gave it political acumen and therefore they should take power. Anyway, after all this, the pro-Western reformers were removed from power, led by Zhao Jiang. That was a very strong historical choice. After 1989, those advocating Westernization and liberalization had no case, and it got worse after what they saw happening once the Soviet Union collapsed. You had those post-1989 period under Jiang Zemin and Hu Wen. Those who advocated liberal democracy and thus free trade were fighting those who sought to revive Chinese, some variant of Chinese socialism. Those were not, Chinese Marxism. These were not the only two options. But the consensus developed that at a minimum, one, the Chinese Communist Party should clearly control, the state, and two, the transition to a market economy such as it was should not be reversed. Those two things are not contradictory whatsoever. Hence, nationalism grew tremendously here. I don't know what it is with people who they need massacres. They need this shocking, they could clutch their pearls. I don't. Most of these massacre stories aren't even true, and yet people desperately need it. Again, this is why I mentioned Sun Yat-sen. Writing on nationalism, you deal with both the state and the ethnos, or the nation proper. That's the one based on language and tradition. National identity can and should include the diversity of various families and clans. But unfortunately, under Mao, a lot of these old traditions that would go into creating the ethnos had been destroyed. Now, Sun Yat-sen, many years prior to this, played a major role in promoting the Han ethnic identity as being crucial to the Chinese nation, rather than worrying about the regional identities that had predominated in the past. It was a unified Han nation, which is the overwhelming majority of the Chinese population. Remember, the old monarchy was a foreign Manchu government. The non-Han population was a tiny percentage of the overall population. However, their lands comprised 64% of the empire, or the country, I should say, and the new Chinese nation. If it let them cut them loose, they'd get much smaller. China would be a much smaller place. So after the initial 1911 revolution, Sun shifted to the idea of the five Chinese nationalities, Han, Manchu, Mongol, Tibetan, and Islamic, trying to claim the entirety of the former empire as Chinese. But this doesn't make a lot of sense. Tradition is appealing to the new nationalism because mainstream Chinese political thought back then was in the process of searching for an educated moral authoritarianism grounded in traditional Chinese statecraft, along with a scientific pragmatism. And obviously it worked. Liberal democracy would be a complete disaster, as it was for Russia. All of Russia's elections were rigged anyway. The medieval Chinese idea, like medievalism in general, comprises this broader tradition of natural law. The future of the people through the proper leadership and righteous governance of the state. And that was a concept that there's an inability of the uneducated common people to achieve an orderly, prosperous society on their own, which is true, without the state, backed by an intellectual, moral elite. Well, liberalism believes the same thing. Political theory in the 90s had a strong emphasis on the need for an authoritarian state to impose not just peace, but an orderly society in which the basic needs of the people could be ensured, which seems simple, but wasn't at the time. Without this, what would happen? You'd have the Opium Wars all over again. Western capital would colonize the system. Something that that came up recently, I missed it at the time. It's only been recently declassified, so I guess there's a good reason I missed it. It's Document 9. It was issued at the 18th Party Congress in 2019. And the reason I came across it is because the Jew Joshua Eisenman referred to the Chinese state as National Socialist. And I think he's one of a handful to actually, he means it negatively, of course. Let me read from it here. It's very interesting. And it wasn't meant really for general circulation. It was just to party members of the city at the time. In this case, he's talking about economics and neoliberalism. Neoliberalism advocates unrestrained economic liberalization, complete privatization, and total marketization, opposes any kind of interference or regulation by the state. Western countries led by the U.S. carry out their neoliberal agendas under the guise of globalization, visiting catastrophic consequences on Latin America, the Soviet Union, Eastern Europe, have also dragged themselves into the international financial crisis, which they have yet to recover. This is mainly expressed in the following ways. Neoliberalism's advocates actively promote the market omnipotence theory. They claim our country, meaning China, our country's macroeconomic control is strangling the market's efficiency and vitality, and they oppose public ownership, arguing that China's state-owned enterprises are national monopolies, inefficient and disruptive of the market economy, and should undergo comprehensive privatization. These arguments aim to change our country's basic economic infrastructure and weaken government's control over the national economy. Now, this was issued in 2019. At this point, it was very clear. Everyone in the universe knew what liberalism did to Russia in the 1990s. No one could actually advocate it unless they were profiting from it directly. National socialism was a perfect transition from the slaughterhouse of Mao to one of the most successful countries on the planet, economically speaking. I mean, there were Maoists around. Mid-level party members, you had plenty of Maoists who wanted to take over. Every once in a while, you come across some reference to Mao being wonderful. It's meant to placate them. It really doesn't, but it's symbolic. President Xi, his report, Jinping, of course, report the 20th Congress of the party in 2022 contains essentially it's a developmental model that continues the break with Marxism. That's nothing new, of course. Now get ready for this title. Hold high the great banner of socialism with Chinese characteristics and strive in unity to build a modern socialist country in all respects. Report to the 20th National Congress of the Communist Party of China. October 16th, 2022. It wasn't that long ago. Basic slogan was to complete the modernization of the economy within the context of a harmonious national and spiritual culture. It was clear, of course, there were many economic systems that they could choose from. But they weren't going to deal with abstract ideologies imposed from a foreign power, like liberalism or Marxism or anything like that. It breaks not only with Marx, but with liberalism too. Neither Marxism nor capitalism tolerate opposition to their own fundamental assumptions and interests. Like Marxism, neoliberal capitalist, the capitalist mentality, it holds that only one path to modernization is possible, and that liberalism itself can't be questioned or rejected, at least not rationally. And yet China is a, among other places, is a standing refutation of that. You've heard the phrase, the Washington Consensus. Any nation, maybe much smaller than China, that struggles to break out of that Washington Consensus is terrorized by the regime's forces in one way or another. It's the target of color revolutions, sanctions, or even military attack. China and Russia are moving towards something like self-sufficiency. And part of this includes, of course, it has to be, strengthening the state sector of the economy with state-owned or more commonly state-controlled companies forming the center of specifically Chinese plan of development. As China today is the primary trading partner of almost 140 nations, and it's proof clearly of a non-liberal development strategy, that mundane concept is revolutionary. It doesn't seem it, but it actually is. The Chinese model is in an excellent position to remake the third world. But you have to have ethnic and basic moral, the overwhelming, you know, you have to be like, you know, Japan or North Korea. You have to be ethnically more or less pure to do so. Mikhail Dilagin, he was deputy chair of the Russian Duma Committee on Economic Policy, he wrote this: "The Chinese were able to creatively adapt the Marxism of the 19th century and its experience of the 20th century to new requirements and implement eternal values with new methods. This is a very important and useful lesson for us. Eternal values with new methods. Implied throughout Xi's report is the importance of the Chinese, the basis of the Chinese foreign policy, the Belt and Road Initiative. And like everything China does, they've succeeded. The Chinese foreign ministry spokesman, at the time anyway, Wang Wenbin, tried to clarify what that meant. He said, the BRI, we call the Belt and Road, transcends the outdated mentality of geopolitical games and created a new model of international cooperation. This is not an exclusive group that excludes other participants, but is an open, inclusive cooperation platform. It is not just China's solo effort, but a symphony performed by all participating nations. I've said 100 times before that internationalism, I really should say, when I said internationalism was vapid, I really should say cosmopolitanism. With nations, when functional nations are respected as such and cooperate, that's very different from cosmopolitanism, which is what the West wants to impose on everybody. Now, the games he's referring to here are clearly zero-sum, not co-prosperity. You've heard that phrase before with Japan. Belt and Road is based on ethnic multilateralism. Now, I don't know, did I coin that phrase? I may have, I'm not sure. Ethnic or ethno-multilateralism, the non-interference in how other states are governed. As of a few years ago, that was the trade amount of the BRI in total. It was about 13 trillion. Now it's about 20 trillion. And much of this derives from the actual manufacture of things, not the financial and fictitious growth instruments of the regime. The institutions I've been talking about for 20 years, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, BRICS, and the Eurasian Economic Union, are the future of national life in contrast to liberalism and cosmopolitanism, as the Washington consensus relies on threats, sanctions, and violence to function. But those threats, I'm happy to say, stopped at the Great Iranian Wall. I'm not talking about Iran, as I mentioned earlier, again, because I predicted all of this stuff. But that's the wall, the threats stopped now. Yes, Donald Trump and possibly those who come after him want to shift U.S. military action to China. I'm not sure what exactly they are that's doing the shifting. They have nothing left. I get the impression, just to as an aside here, that the destruction suffered by Israel is far worse than suffered by Iran. And the, well, I mean, you know, the media is Jewish to a great extent, so it's very easy to create this censorship where no pictures of that are permitted. We've already talked about how Israel has been utterly decimated. Its institutions inflamed, went up in flames, and millions have left the country. Let alone we talk about things like desertion from the military, on and on and on. Anyway, the Washington consensus was made even worse, the Davos Forum, the Great Reset. It's a revolutionary doctrine. Europe is in the midst of a massive self-inflicted depression, devastation, darkness. Internally ravaged regime is forced to rely on strip mining. Whatever's left from existing capital and the assets of its wealthy allies, so to speak. The importation of millions of hostile young male so-called refugees, overwhelmingly male, from Africa and Asia to Europe serves to silence any real working class revolt, and they keep wages low as Ukraine is being depopulated to stop the real nationalist challenge, not the ones that you see on TV. But I see the riots that have occurred from time to time in Britain and Ireland. There is still life in us yet, thank God Almighty. The massive spike in crime these invaders have caused, yes, it keeps a lot of people at home. But the crimes of these people and the cover-up from the press is too much for any normal person to bear. And we know how the governments in both Ireland and Britain have responded to this. And it turns out even mild criticism of this plan, of this scheme, is met with prison sentence. And in the U.S., maybe not a prison sentence, but persecution. Now back to China here. In his report, President Xi says the following. To uphold and develop Marxism, and I put that in quotes, we must integrate it with China's fine traditional culture. Only by taking root in the rich historical and cultural soil of the country can the truth of Marxism flourish here. With a history stretching back to antiquity, China's traditional culture is extensive, profound. It is the crystallization of the wisdom of Chinese civilization. Our traditional culture espouses many important principles and concepts, including things like pursuing the common good for all, regarding the people as the foundation of the state, governing by virtue, discarding the outdated in favor of the new, selecting officials on the basis of merit, promoting harmony between humanity and nature, ceaselessly pursuing self-improvement, embracing the world with virtue, acting in good faith and being friendly to others, and fostering neighborliness. All right, I have to take issue with him here. You understand where he's going. Marxism can never be mixed with those things. Marxism considers any cultural tradition as a result of alienation and of one class's rule over another. That's why they're destroyed. He's talking about not so much Marxism, maybe it's just a matter of translation, but socialism. So to uphold and develop national socialism, we must integrate the economic idea of socialism with China's traditional culture. That makes a lot more sense than Marxism, which is in the official translation. Now, our traditional culture, you know, what he wrote there, every culture espouses these things. However, regarding the people as the foundation of the state, well, I don't know what that means. Usually it's divinity, it's divine power. Not the people. Governing by virtue, etc. Well, most civilizations have this as their center. I don't know if this is coded language or not. There's nothing special about the Chinese tradition if that's all it promoted. I do believe he's saying a lot more in reality than his words suggest. Then he says, these maxims have taken shape over centuries of work and life, reflect the Chinese people's way of viewing the universe, the world, society, morality, and are highly consistent with the propositions of scientific socialism. Marxism isn't even remotely the issue here. In this context, he means socialism as in the sense of national socialism, not Marxism. You put Marxism in there, or you remove Marxism from there, national socialism instead, it then flows. But Marxism, or Maoism, Leninism, it doesn't make any sense. However, it's there to placate the hardcore Marxists that still exist within the party. Now, I know they seem like trite and harmless platitudes, but they're strong rebukes to liberalism and oligarchy. Notice that nothing that he listed above are represented in the market economy, even at its best. What about things like virtue and the common good? These are outside of the ken for most theories of right and liberalism. The creation of a mass society destroys any conception of a rational self, or even the community that can create such selves. Liberalism has no conception of the hierarchy of values, since everything ultimately is reducible to money or some quantitative advantage. Decoding his words here, you could write a book on it. Now, you can laugh saying medieval Chinese culture, and he lists a bunch of things that everyone believes, pretty much. I think he means a lot more than that, and I think his audience knew this too. I don't speak Chinese. I'm getting the official translation, the official Chinese translation, actually. So there could be inconsistencies there. I don't know. But still, it's very important. The typical libertarian or liberal, neoliberal, sees the common good as something impractical or bad for business. Now, from this party congress, there were five principles of peaceful coexistence. This is supposed to be the bedrock principles of Chinese foreign policy. And these are the following. Number one, mutual respect for sovereignty and territorial integrity. Again, you could write a book on what that means. It refers to the development of regional and national identities. It's a rebuke to liberalism, of course. Two is an obvious one, mutual non-aggression. The U.S. has no business in the Far East, period. Number three, non-interference in the internal affairs of other nations. Number four, equity and mutual benefit. And finally, five, peaceful coexistence. Number five would be the result of one through four. Again, what it sounds like, just a bunch of platitudes strung together, the scholar knows how to read into this language, get to the root of its meaning. And I say it's a brief manifesto for social nationalism. It's a repudiation of the idea that nationalism is a violent, destructive force. It's a declaration of war against liberalism, which leads to imperialism. And after all, a nationalist can't be consistent if he seeks to destroy or damage another nation, all other factors being equal, of course. Like everything else, liberalism's connection to the nation is purely rhetorical and empty. Liberalism can function only to the extent that it lives off, like a parasite, the influence of national religious culture. Nationalism for the Western ruling class, the regime, could be something temporarily useful to harm a non-liberal enemy, like, Albania or Ukraine. The regime condemned Ukrainian nationalism 20 years ago, but supports it in recent years. Although the version of nationalism they're promoting has nothing to do with actual Ukrainian nationalism. I strongly recommend you get my book that has that as a title from Amazon. It takes a long time, but I get deeply into what exactly true Ukrainian nationalism is. Now, concerning the type of nationalism that both creates and derives from these actions, the party states officially, "The people's support is of the utmost importance. The United Front is an effective instrument for rallying people's support and pooling their strength. We will build a strong United Front to forge great unity and solidarity. We will encourage all the sons and daughters of the Chinese nation to dedicate themselves to realizing the Chinese dream of national rejuvenation. We will leverage the strength of our country's new type of socialist political party system. Following the principles of long-term coexistence, mutual oversight, sincerity, and sharing in rough times and the smooth times, we'll strengthen the party's unity and cooperation with other political parties and prominent figures without party affiliation. We'll also support other political parties in improving themselves and performing their roles more effectively. We will, with a focus on forging a strong sense of community for the Chinese nation, continue to take a correct and distinctly Chinese approach to handling ethnic affairs, uphold and improve the system of regional ethnic autonomy, and improve the party's work on ethnic affairs so as to comprehensively promote ethnic unity and progress. We will remain committed to the principle that religions in China must be Chinese in orientation and provide active guidance so they can adapt to socialist society. We will strengthen communication with intellectuals who are not party members on theoretical or political issues, and improve our work concerning people from emerging social groups in an effort to provide better political guidance for pursuing common goals. We will cultivate a cordial and clean relationship between government and business across the board and facilitate the healthy development of non-public sectors and those working in it. We will improve and strengthen our work related to Chinese national overseas interests to give shape to a powerful joint force for advancing the rejuvenation of the Chinese nation. Now, I quoted that at length. And, you know, the word party is translated, but really what it means is interests. Different social forces, I think, is what he really means here. But again, that's another brief manifesto of this new form of government. It permits a wide range of ideological expressions, stopping short of tolerating anything anti-Chinese, like, you know, actual Marxism or liberalism. In other words, a public ideology cannot be foreign, as Marxist-Leninism was to everyone. It's hardly an unreasonable demand. In 1984, Deng Xiaoping said, concerning the ideological justification for his new path, he said the following. He said, "What is socialism? What is Marxism? We're not quite clear about this in the past. Marxism has its utmost importance to developing productive forces. We have said that socialism is a primary stage of communism, not at the advanced stage, the principle, from each according to his ability, each according to his needs, will be applied. This calls for healthy developed productive forces and an overwhelming abundance of material wealth. Therefore, the fundamental task of the socialist stage is to develop productive forces. The superiority of the socialist system is demonstrated in the final analysis by faster and greater development of those forces than the capitalist system. As they develop, people's material and cultural life will constantly improve. One of our shortcomings after the founding of the People's Republic is that we didn't pay enough attention to developing productive forces. Socialism means eliminating poverty. Pauperism is not socialism, still less communism." Deng Xiaoping is someone you could write about, of course, you know, for days and days and days, saying that they weren't clear about what socialism or Marxism was in the past is a jab at Mao. True Maoist, true socialist, despised Deng Xiaoping. There's nothing wrong from each according to his ability, each according to his needs. There's nothing wrong with that. That's a simple principle of justice. But in order to get there, there has to be a strong development of productive forces, of course. He's at a stage where these are being developed, and once they're developed, it'll be much easier to create a just system and held together exclusively by Chinese nationalism. That's the only thing that holds it together. That is to say, Han nationalism. That's why above, he talked about, not Deng Xiaoping, but above, he talked about regional autonomies. There's an official program that has been pursued for a long time, a very expensive one, trying to equalize the poorer parts of the country, especially in the far west and north, with the center areas and southern areas. You know, the non-Han population are a tiny percentage of the population of China, but their lands are far larger, as I already mentioned. So the CIA has decided to go after them and make up all kinds of garbage about what's going on in Xinjiang or Tibet. But this kind of talk only makes sense when you include socialism in the sense of national socialism, not cosmopolitan materialism. That is not what's being promoted. It can't be promoted this way. The phrase socialist civilization, it's a Chinese construct, and it is closely related to the present ideology of the party, representative of the Chinese nation. It has nothing to do with Marx, nothing to do with Mao. It replaces the notion of a struggle between two industrial classes with the harmony derived from ethnic and national culture. The existence of these classes are unavoidable. As I've said now four times, the party's central mission is to make sure that a bourgeoisie doesn't develop. And classes don't get, you know, there isn't one very wealthy class ruling above the others. I mean, to some extent, inequality is built into nature. Everyone knows that. People are not equal to one another. But the party being in control means that the party has to be more powerful than all economic forces put together. The concept was created to protect China from foreign liberal influences and is the highest form of representation, true representation. They use the word spiritual over and over again. I think that term was introduced to move away from the materialism, which is typical of both Marxist and liberal ideologies. The spiritual side of civilization is independent from the rest of society and serves as its foundation other than being its creation. There's nothing more anti-communist than that. The Chinese like to create lists, and I like that. It's very orderly. In 2004, they came out with the three represents. And these are, number one, represent the development trend of China's advanced productive forces. Number two, represent the orientation of China's advanced culture. And number three, represent the fundamental interests of the overwhelming majority of the Chinese people. Again, these seem like, you know, platitudes. But China is actually in a position to do it. See, the upshot of all of it, the rejection of class-based a view of history and Marxist economics as a whole. The culture is a foundation for society, and something specifically Chinese must exist along with the growth of any form of social productive forces have to develop so that justice can be done. It's a precondition, in fact, of any form of national development. By using the phrase overwhelming majority, the party is rejecting such reductionist terms like proletariat and Marxism in general. The Americans created all these euphemisms for describing China's total upending of the economic order, and they've done that, which is a good thing. Remember, Janet Yellen, I think it was, who said, China is now simply too large for the rest of the world to absorb this enormous capacity. Actions taken by the PRC today can shift world prices. When the global market is flooded with cheap Chinese goods, the viability of American firms is put into question. That's what she said. This is a big problem. The important distinction to note in the above statement that for a long time the term cheap used to define Chinese goods often underhandedly referred to their quality. But here, the former Secretary of the Treasury, Janet Yellen, is referring to cheap as in price. It's a significant distinction. If something is doesn't cost as much, you call it inexpensive, not cheap. One's a quantitative, the other's a qualitative descriptor. Chinese manufacturing processes today now have far exceeded that of the West. I don't know if you guys have seen the Xiaomi e-car factory that created its own native Jija press, that aluminum die press that could punch out the frame of a car in one piece, the single-piece casting process. The claim is they can pump out a car every 17 seconds. That's one of the things that led to Janet being sent to China. To please slow down and not embarrass them anymore. The U.S. funds wars. China funds development. The current American debt is $40 trillion. I have the debt clock open right in front of me. 137% of nominal GDP. $17 trillion has been spent on wars. That means quite literally half of the entire American debt was blown on endless, mindless, and genocidal conflicts that went nowhere, that the U.S. lost. China hasn't spent a cent on this. You know, it has a military, you know, a very large one, but it doesn't have an empire. It doesn't seek one. This is why the Chinese can create things less expensively. One result of all this is that China is winning a huge share of construction projects in Africa, accounting for 31% of African infrastructure, compared with 12% for Western firms. That's just one example. It's a total misuse of taxpayer funds. Went into creating half of this debt, and none of it benefited the average American citizen. The entire operation was carried out by an ethnic cabal within the U.S. government, loyalties only to Israel and no one else. The PNAC clan, who masterminded the entire breadth of the 21st century, these wars have engulfed America in shame and misery, irreversibly gutting the country and squandering its global standing. Not that it ever really should have had global standing. It should be a regional hegemon. These wars have done zero to assist Americans in any way, in any capacity. Israel is a dangerous parasite sucking the lifeblood out of America, forcing the host to wage unnecessary wars on its behalf. I don't have to, you know, most of my listeners are aware of this. My enemies were listening to this. Too bad that happens to be true. No matter how you put it, it's true. The U.S. gets no oil from the Persian Gulf. The U.S. gets no oil from Iraq or anywhere in the area, actually. The U.S. could be totally self-sufficient in oil if it wasn't for the environmentalist movement. That's a separate issue. But this last Iranian debacle is the last, or I should say the latest in the long line of failure. But I guarantee you no lessons will be learned. China doesn't have this problem. There is no parasitical group dominating their country's leadership. Therefore, it could focus on actual development. China doesn't create vassals like the U.S. does. It forms partnerships. China spends far less spreading its influence because that influence has compounding abilities, owing to the fair bilateral nature of China's arrangements through the Belt and Road. The U.S. has to spend excessive amounts to maintain the same level of influence because that influence is totally artificial, invented out of a poisonous mixture of fear, mafia tactics, and sanctions. I appreciate everyone who have listened to this point. I think I've made my point here about the development, the recent development of the Chinese nation, where it came from, and where it might be going. There are many problems. There's many struggles. After the COVID thing in China, I don't know, 200 people were arrested. I think there's been some executions even. There is zero in the U.S. as far as I know. Remember, in the East, the state is more powerful than capital. In the West, capital is more powerful than the state. Thank you, my friends, for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.